Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. Happy holidays and welcome back to the Bill Press Pod. Yeah, it seemed like sheer hell while we were living through Donald Trump's last year in office. But how bad was it really, the year 2020? You know what? Even worse than we thought, as I realized, after reading Jonathan Karl's new book, Betrayal, The Final Act of the Trump Show. For all 4 years of the Trump presidency, Jonathan Karl had a front row seat, literally, in the front row of the White House briefing room for ABC News. You may remember, after Trump had told so many lies about COVID-19 being no worse than the flu, Jonathan Karl's the guy who asked Trump, quote, "Why did you lie to the American people, and why should we believe anything you say now?" And looking back now, Karl says that given all that Trump tried to do to undermine the election of 2020, we're lucky our democracy survived. Betrayal is by far the best book I've read about the closing days of the Trump White House, and Jonathan Karl joins us today to tell us all about it. Jonathan Karl, hello, hello, and welcome back to the Bill Press Pod.
Bill, great to be here.
I must say I'm going to have to admit that I was wrong. At one time I said, Jonathan Karl, that your book, Front Row of the Trump Show, was the best book written about the Trump presidency. Now that I've read your new book, Betrayal, I think this one's even better. So
well, thank
congratulations.
You. Thank you. I appreciate it. I think it's the most important work that I've done as a journalist, and I, you know, I poured everything into this one.
Yeah, you sure did. And the show. So I want to ask you, when did you realize you were there covering the campaign, but then you were in the White House? And in the front row, president of our White House Correspondents Association, when did you realize that this presidency was not just like any other presidency, that this one was fundamentally different?
I mean, I think that probably happened before he was elected.
Yeah.
I mean, it was clear that's where we were heading. But there was one moment early on that I just realized that there was just – we were in entirely different territory here. And that was when, you know, Trump, in a random tweet, if I recall, it was on a Saturday, accused Barack Obama of wiretapping Trump Tower. And not only was that just bonkers, and not only did he spell wiretap with two P's, but none of his people had any idea what he was talking about. I mean, I reached out to Reince Priebus right after the thing went out, and he had no idea. He said, "I'm trying to find out." Reince was the chief of staff at the time. So here you had a completely unhinged allegation made by a current president of a president that just left office. And usually, you know, there's deference given by both, you know, former presidents who keep quiet, current presidents who don't take time to attack their predecessors. So that was completely thrown off. And you had a sitting president of the United States making ridiculous allegations with no evidence that his people were totally unaware of.
So it worked up to September 10, 2020, when you asked the president, and I quote, "Why did you lie to the American people, and why should we trust what you have to say now?" You must have known he would go nuclear when you asked that question.
I did, and I have to confess, when I asked that question, although the specific subject was COVID and what he had told Bob Woodward, we had him on tape back in April of 2020 acknowledging that he knew full well the extent of the disease. Actually, there was a Woodward tape from February, even before he had come out and said ridiculous things like it's just like the flu. We knew that he knew, not only, we always knew that he was saying something that was not true, but here we had cold hard evidence that he knew what he was saying was not true, right. And he even explained why he said it. So it was by any definition a lie, an intentional lie. But my confession, Bill, is that when I asked that question, I intentionally left it exactly as you read, not specific to that, because in a way I felt that it was a question that covered all 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you lie to the American people? Not just about this. I mean, he had been lying consistently since he took office. And why should we trust anything you have to say now? So it was specifically brought on by the smoking gun evidence that Bob Woodward produced. But it was a question that I thought got to the core essence of the Trump presidency.
And then, as expected, he went on the attack against you. Did you suffer by being blackballed or cut out of events or cut out of interviews from the White House, at the White House for a while?
You know, first of all, it was interesting to see how it truly rattled him. He came back and he called me a disgrace to the ABC television network. He went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth after I started with that question. And then he took two more questions very quickly and ended the press conference. And it was clear that he was rattled. And he's not a guy that you normally see rattled. And that did surprise me. In terms of getting, you know, blackballed, one thing I learned is there's an expression, and I forget who first said this, that when you try to like suck up to somebody in power to get the good stuff, you realize there really is no good stuff. You know, the good stuff's vastly overrated. They're going to give you what they want to give you, what they want to get out. And look, I had already been, you know, I mean, his press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, I had already called out for being essentially a political propagandist. And, you know, I wasn't exactly talking much to her anyway. Other people in the Trump White House will talk to you, I found, regardless, because they're usually out to get somebody else in the Trump White House. So I didn't notice any significant change, actually, besides him yelling at me on national television and calling me a disgrace.
So this was COVID related. Would you agree that how Trump handled COVID is basically the central story of his presidency?
Well,
it certainly occupies a great deal of your book, Betrayal. Yes,
it does. My only hesitation on that is his attack on our democracy. What he did, both in the lead up to the election, he'd certainly laid the groundwork for doing it. But what he did during the transition that led up to January 6th, it's hard to You know, mm-hmm. it's like what's more defining, mishandling of a pandemic that killed hundreds of thousands of Americans, or a frontal assault on American democracy? I mean, I think they're both pretty big.
Good, yeah, good point. Do you think had he handled COVID better, he would have been reelected?
I was of the feeling that he was almost certainly to lose no matter what, because, you know, he won in 2016. It was, as I called it in front row at the Trump show, it was a black swan event. Black swan events don't tend to happen twice in a row. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to give him credit. It was the greatest upset in the history of American politics. But he had spent the following 3 years before COVID systematically alienating the very people that he would need to win re-election, independents, women. So I think that it was unlikely, he's unlikely to win on any circumstances. But I do believe that if there was a way for him to win, the handling of COVID provided an opportunity. If he had handled it better, and even as late as getting COVID himself, he gets COVID, he is medevaced to Walter Reed. He's even before that, he's put on oxygen. His chief of staff is afraid that he may die, and he recovers. And he does that cinematic return to the White House at sunset on Marine One, and the walk up the stairs and the taking off the mask and all that stuff. But if he had used that and come out and said, I've now seen it, I've experienced it, I've felt it, it almost took my life, take this thing seriously, I don't know if it would have been enough for him to win, but I think that it would have changed the race, would have made a difference. But instead, he, you know, there's like nothing. Yeah. There's nothing after that.
Right. As you indicated, he was like, he was take off his, open his shirt and have a Superman shirt right under it. I've conquered this. Which gets me as closely as I followed this, the Trump campaign or the Trump presidency, and thought I knew it all. There's a lot of new stuff in your book that I didn't realize. And you just touched on one of the points. He was a lot sicker than we thought or than the White House let us know, which even led to more lies from the White House and from the White House doctors about his situation.
Yeah, I tried to spell this out because I thought, look, doctors or White House is lying about a president's medical condition. Now, that is something that is not new to Donald Trump. We've seen that, you know, with Woodrow Wilson. We saw it with JFK. We've saw it, you know, we've seen it over and over again. But this, they were just flat out lying. They weren't like not disclosing. They were proactively saying things that were just not true, including, you know, his own doctor through statements. I mean, I expect the lies to come from the press secretary at that point, but to hear the president's doctor, I guess with the Ronnie Jackson experience, maybe I shouldn't have been all that surprised, just flat out lying about his condition.
Was he told by Trump to tell that lie?
You know, Trump did, I describe in the book, choreograph just about everything that that the doctor said. So I don't have a direct line that Trump said, go out and say X, Y, and Z, but I mean, he was choreographing the whole thing. So he was clearly acting on Trump's wishes, whether or not it was a direct, you know, instruction from Trump or not. I mean, I recount in the book, you remember the striking image of the team of doctors all in their white coats, in formation, walking out in front. It was really a really amazing image. I remember at the time, wow, that's impressive. And that was Trump from his bed, hospital bed, saying, "You guys, the coats, got to keep them on. I want you all out there." The guy knows television. He knows images. Mm-hmm. He does.
Jumping around, but one other area that where I thought excellent reporting. Let's go to January 6th. Trump is at the White House. There are a lot of people saying, you've got to do something, you've got to do something. Trump, it took him a long time to agree to make any statement, right? And then the statement he did make was not what people were saying he ought to say.
This was a moment of unusual candor from Kevin McCarthy. He did, I think, 3 or 4 interviews that afternoon. But the interview he did on ABC, which I set up by reaching out directly to him, and he did an interview with Stephanopoulos, he actually used the word beg. He was begging. He said he called and he was begging Trump to get on television and to tell his supporters to back down and to condemn what was happening. And it was still a couple of hours after that before he does anything. And when he finally agrees to tape this video message, you're right. It was awful. I mean, he literally says, "We love you," to the rioters. He tells them to go home, but follows it up with the message of, you know, "We love you." And he talks about, he repeats all the stuff about the election lies, everything else. The only good words in that videotaped message, which was sent out via Twitter, shot in the Rose Garden, was the words, "Go home now." But it's packed before and after with message of praise for the people that are even at that moment still, you know, rampaging through the Capitol. And what I learned is I actually talked to one of the people that was present in the Rose Garden for the taping of that message. And what I learned is there were several takes before he got to the one they used that were deemed unacceptable. And the reason why was that he did not include the words "go home." It was just praise for the rioters and nothing else.
Meanwhile, his vice president is stuck on the loading dock under the Hart building of the Capitol. And he does not call to say, "Mike, how are you doing? Everything okay?" Right? No word to Pence.
I mean, I was covering this. I was working around the clock on January 6th throughout the following days. And the question I asked several times a day at the time was, has the president reached out to the vice president? Because even after it was over, did he reach out to him and say, hey, sorry about that, Mike, or, you know, hey, you okay? What's And it was days and days and days. They finally arrange an awkward Oval Office meeting for the two of them that's billed as to talk about the week ahead. And then they put out like this joint statement saying they discussed the issues for the next. And in that conversation, the subject of January 6th does not actually even come up.
You also, you start the book by talking about the your interview with Trump, I guess it was in March, no?
March 18th of this year, yes.
At Mar-a-Lago. And you ask him his reaction to people who were chanting, hang Mike Pence in front of the Capitol. Even you must have been a little stunned by his response.
I was, and the context is before I asked specifically about Pence, I asked about January 6th, and I asked about that tweet he put out that evening after the videotaped message where he said, remember this day forever. One question I've had since that moment was, what do you want me to remember about it? Yeah, I mean, what exactly are we remembering? Because I actually agree we better remember this day forever, but I've got a hunch that we have a different set of reasons. And he made it clear in his answer to me that he thinks of that day very fondly because he saw that his supporters came from all over the country and they came to fight for him. And I can't tell you how many times that I heard Trump or heard of him saying to people, the problem is you people aren't fighting for me, to his staff, to the Republicans on the Hill. And now he had people coming to fight for him. And he did say to me, well, it was marred a little later on. Marred. He didn't say how exactly, but I guess that means when they beat up Capitol police officers and stormed their way in, I'm not sure. But then I turned to Pence, and yeah, when there isn't a, he says he wasn't worried about him. He knew he was fine. He knew he was totally fine. And the hang Mike Pence, he proceeds to justify it. And that, I think that phrase that he said to me, it's common sense, John. Now, even if we give him the benefit of the doubt, who knows? I've had arguments with people about this. Is he saying it's common sense that you would be chanting hang Mike Pence? I don't personally think so, but I've just asked him about that. And he's saying it's common sense that people are angry because Pence should have done what he said and overturned the election. I mean, it's, but the callousness, the lack of any empathy or any concern, and literally justifying, explaining in a positive way, the actions of people who wanted to murder his vice president is I think of an entirely, I mean, it's actually of a new level even for Trump.
Absolutely. Unbelievable. You also were the first to report that Donald Trump talked to the Republican National Chair, Ronna McDaniel, and said, I'm quitting. I'm leaving the Republican Party. He didn't. So why?
So first of all, it wasn't a threat. It was a statement of fact. Huh. He told her that he was leaving. He was done. It was over. He was starting his own party. And to me, like so much about Trump is cinematic and how he how he does things. This was such a dramatic moment because the conversation is taking place on Air Force One, just after he has gone up the steps of the plane for the very last time to take the flight home to Florida on January 20th. And she's simply calling to give him, wish him well, because she couldn't be at his little farewell ceremony. And she's really upset about this. And she starts saying, you can't do this. This, you're going to destroy us. We will never win again. And according, extremely well-sourced, direct witness to this conversation, said that Trump's response is exactly, you'll never win again. And his attitude was, I lost. You need to lose too. Everybody around me needs to lose. And the reason why he backed down is because the RNC got together over the course of the next several days and made it clear to him that if he went through with this, it was going to cost him tens of millions of dollars. Legal fees were not going to be paid. They were paying the legal fees related to election challenges. They were going to move those right over to him, stop paying them. But more significantly, the single most valuable thing that Donald Trump has, political asset, is the database of 40 plus million people that have given money to him. And they rent that out to Republican candidates all across the country. They make millions of dollars renting it out And they were going to say, we will render that asset useless by giving it to everybody for free. You'll never be able to charge anybody for it again.
So again, with Donald Trump, it comes back to the follow the money, I guess,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
One thing that I enjoyed about your book particularly was you identify several bad guys. At least my conclusion was I would label them as bad guys in the administration, but also refreshingly, several good guys. Among the good guys, John Kelly, mm-hmm. Mark Milley, and Brad Raffensperger, of course, who was not a member of the administration. Tell us about Kelly's role and Milley's role particularly.
And there were others, and it is reassuring. And, you know, this also kind of brings up a debate about what do you do if, I mean, you're in the administration. I mean, you got there. Yeah. So you're there.
Right.
And Trump is doing what he's doing. Do you resign in protest? Do you leave or do you stay? In many cases, resigning in protest is the only option. But some of these people felt a need to stay to basically do their part to save the republic from the president they were serving. This is kind of the anonymous op-ed, anonymous book.
Yeah, right.
You know, Miles Taylor. Now we know, but it's an interesting approach. But Kelly, you know, Kelly was obviously out. By the end of 2018, and he, you know, he tried, I think, more than anybody in that West Wing to keep things on the tracks. And you know, there's a lot of things to criticize Kelly about. He was an architect of the policy on the border before he left DHS. But he was the guy that I called on January 6th, really my first call when I saw the people going into the building, or even storming through the barricades before they got in. I called him up because I recount this story that when I was working on Front Row, I had asked Kelly, it was almost like an aside because it wasn't the focus of the book at all at this point. Remember, Front Row, I'd finished before any of this. I said, what happens if he loses? Will he leave? I mean, it was kind of a crazy question. Of course he leaves. That's what you do. We've done this since poor John Adams had to leave after the 1800 election. And he said, oh yeah, no, he'll leave. Don't worry about that. And if he refuses to, there are people that will escort him out. Oh my God, this is pretty dramatic. And then he added the line to me, which I'll never forget. You know, he could chain himself to the Resolute. Somebody will go over and cut the chains and escort him out.
God, imagine.
And it seemed nutty, but here we saw January 6th. So I called him up. I was like, okay, what's going on? Who's got the chain cutter, you know? And he, without failing, without hesitating for a moment, said that the cabinet should convene immediately and invoke the 25th Amendment, declare the president mentally unfit and remove him from office. Didn't happen, obviously, but there were people in that cabinet who I outlined in the book who actually did discuss that, surprisingly, given who they were. But so I think a good guy. Obviously, Milley was really hurt by what happened in the march through Lafayette Square and the St. John's Church disaster. And I think felt that he was used, felt that his uniform was used, his position was used by Trump. I kind of outline in detail what happened on that day. But the way he and Mark Esper, and I put Mark Esper in another category as somebody who did the right thing.
I would add him too, right.
Really did everything they could, the two of them, and they worked in tandem. To try to prevent Trump from plunging us into a crisis that might have been, you know, far more devastating.
Right, making it clear that they were against sending the military into the streets of America to overturn the election. Among the bad guys, there are several, of course, Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and all the rest. Mark Meadows, I came away from your book, one of the takeaways was that Mark Meadows was really more of a key player in everything that Trump did wrong that we may have imagined, right?
I mean, absolutely central. Yes, I think that's absolutely central to everything. You know, one of the things that was fascinating to me as I was doing the reporting for the book, and I went through and I talked to everybody who would talk to me, and I was surprised that most of them agreed to talk to me. Not all on the record. Some actually put stuff on the record. But the one consistent theme by people who were there and weren't the truly, you know, insane people, not the Rudy Giulianis and the Sidney Powells, but the people that trying to keep things from truly breaking apart, all had something to say about Mark Meadows and about how he fueled all of this. It wasn't like that it was his idea. He wasn't the one bringing in the conspiracy theories himself. He wasn't the one, but he enabled Trump at every turn. He forced others to act on the wackiest, most dangerous things. I recount John Ratcliffe, who was the director of National Intelligence. He gets a phone call on his cell phone late at night from Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani. This is the top intelligence official in the United States government. And he's got a conference call of crazy. The two of them start talking to him about this thing, about how these two CIA supercomputers that were used to rig votes did it, you know, it's QAnon stuff. Okay. And he, you know, Ratcliffe, who seems as Trumpy as they can come, but he's like, what are these people doing calling me? But he immediately, from the conversation, it becomes immediately clear that Mark Meadows is the one that has given out his cell phone number. Mm. And, you know, there's another call that I outline of Sidney Powell calling a top official, Ezra Cohen, at the Defense Department. And again, the suspicion is, we don't know for sure, but very few people had this direct line. How do they get it? It seems like Mark Meadows, his fingerprints are somewhere, everywhere, at every turn. That's why the January 6th committee has put the fight over his subpoena very high on their priority list, as they should.
Back to my category of bad guys and good guys, if you allow me that license, where would you put Bill Barr?
You can say lots of things about Bill Barr and about what he did before the election. You can talk about the way he undermined Mueller. You can talk about the way he put his fingers on the scale for Trump's political allies as they were being prosecuted. Right. You can talk about him raising questions about the integrity of mail-in voting before the election. There's a laundry list of things that if you want to have a rap sheet on Bill Barr, there you are. But I think that Barr's decision to, first of all, refuse Trump's demands that he use the power of the Justice Department to overturn the election. He refused to go out and seize voting machines. He refused to do all this stuff, which would have been illegal, let's face it. But who's going to stop him if he's determined to break the law? He's the top law enforcement official in the land. And then when he comes out, and I devote an entire chapter to this, when Barr comes out and tells the world that there was no widespread fraud in the election, it's one of the single most important moments in the transition, and it's Barr, and he did the right thing. And I hear from people, oh, Barr's just trying to, you know, revive his reputation, and, you know, let's not let him do this. And people are obsessed with wanting to attack Barr. I mean, it's fine. Go attack Barr for all you want for what he's done over the course of his career. I who cares? Do that. Barr's reputation is meaningless at this point. The guy's never going to be attorney general again. He's not running for office. He's retired and working on his memoirs. I'm not concerned about Barr's reputation, but what I'm concerned with is what his actions did to prevent a far greater catastrophe. And it's especially notable when you consider that Barr leaves on the, and I don't have my own book in front of me right now, but I think it's the 14th of December. And the 15th of December, or that's when he tells Trump he's leaving. On the 15th of December, what does Trump do? He brings in the soon-to-be acting attorney general, Rosen, thinking, aha, we're finally getting rid of Barr. I'm going to get this guy to do all the stuff that Barr refused to do. And of course, Rosen refuses as well, leading to Trump's effort to find yet another acting attorney general with the Jeffrey Clark debacle in early January. And here's a theme. You mentioned the good guys and the bad guys. The good guys, to use your term here, many of them are people where there's nothing in their background that would suggest that they would stand up and prevent, you know, stand up for good, stand up against Donald Trump, and to keep Donald Trump from effectively destroying our country. It's some of the people that have been the most loyal to him. I mean, Pence is the most obvious example. Never once crossed Trump, not even during the campaign, during the Access Hollywood thing, never once crossed Trump, and he does what he does on January 6th. Barr, as we just discussed. Brad Raffensperger is a Republican, you know, relatively low-level Republican operative, Trump supporter in Georgia. Who knew that he would be a profile in courage? And he was. The legislative leader in Michigan who gets summoned to the White House, ordered by Trump to convene and send a new batch of electoral votes to Washington. Those guys are Trump supporters, elected to office by Republicans who love Donald Trump. They stood up and they looked the president in the eye in the Oval Office and they said no, and issued a statement within just about 15 minutes of leaving the Oval Office saying that they had refused him. So imagine if any of those people along the way had been like Mark Meadows and were willing to do anything, the outcome could have been much worse.
Yeah, you make that point in the book. Had they not done what they had done, things could have been exactly a lot worse. Jonathan Karl, our guest, author of the new book, Betrayal, The Final Act of the Trump Show. It may not be the final act, Jonathan. You've been talking about that lately. What happens and how do reporters respond if Donald Trump becomes the candidate again in 2024? After a quick break, I want to ask you about that here on the Bill Press Pod. So hold on. We'll be right back with Jonathan Karl. For today's break and for today's sponsor, let me tell you about someone and something very special. This, of course, the holiday season. We're all looking for something special for someone we love. And there is no better gift than a hand-woven scarf by the real talent in our family, my wife, Carol. You've heard me talk about Carol Scarves before. She is an award-winning weaver. She specializes in original rayon chenille and bamboo scarves, each one of which she designs and weaves herself. It's come in a great variety of colors and designs, which you can find out if you just check out our website for a full look at what's available at carolpressscarves.com. But you got to do it soon. In fact, do it today because it's important, of course, for you and Carol that she get your scarf in the mail in time for the holidays. Again, check out our website at carolpressscarves.com. Treat yourself or someone you love to an original Carol Press scarf for this holiday season.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
And we're back on the Bill Press Pod. The new book is Betrayal, The Final Act of the Trump Show. You think you know what happened in that last year? No, you don't. Not until you read this book. It's a great book by good friend Jonathan Karl from ABC News. You make this point on a personal level that you decided that Trump's presidency required that you approach your job, I guess, a little differently, right? That you could not just cover Trump and report on what he said without pointing out it wasn't true.
Yeah, I had, and this is even before the year 2020, I just had several moments where you're faced with this incredible situation where it may be irresponsible to air, to broadcast the words of the president of the United States. And sometimes even if you were going to point out why what he has said is a lie, what's wrong with it, everything else, his words from that pulpit speak really loudly. And when you have him saying things to the world that are not true, and especially as COVID hits, actually could be deadly, how do you handle that as a journalist? How do you, I mean, what I started doing was often characterizing what he said, but not airing the actual words. Mm-hmm. And if I airing them with lots of context before and after. So if he's running for president again, and I, as you alluded to, I have my doubts that he will. By the way, betrayal is the final act of the Trump show. The curtain has not fallen. The betrayal is still active. It's a question of, you know, how close we are to that curtain falling.
But just to jump in, that's an important point. I mean, as you do point out, the coup or the attempted coup is not over, right? I mean, he's still at it.
He's still at it, and he's trying methodically to erase, to destroy anybody who stood in his way. Obviously, the 10 who voted for impeachment in the House, the senators who voted to convict him in the Senate trial. He's trying to get rid of Brad Raffensperger in Georgia. He's trying to get rid of similar Republican leaders, making it a litmus test for anybody for his endorsement to echo his lies about 2020. No, he is still very much at it. He doesn't have the power of the presidency, which is a huge difference, but he is still very much at it.
So were he to become and you and Brian Stelter talked about this on CNN, Reliable Sources, were he to become a candidate, and who's going to stand in his way, we might ask, in 2024, how do reporters, how the networks cover his campaign?
Not like a regular campaign, particularly the cables, because obviously, you know, the cable network, you know, you would traditionally, there'd be times when you would air an entire speech by a candidate. I mean, I can't imagine that ever happening outside of Fox and Newsmax and the various outlets on the right. But what does a debate look like? You remember what those debates were like in 2020. But are the networks going to turn over? And I don't know. I'm not the decision maker here, just to be clear. I'm just a reporter. But do the networks turn over 2 hours of airtime to Donald Trump on a stage, knowing that he's going to be rapid fire repeating lies? I'm not sure that happens. And if it doesn't happen, how do you cover a debate where you're not, I mean, to cover a campaign where you can't even kind of air a debate? It's really disturbing. It's really, because look, in my DNA, I don't take sides. I'm a reporter and I'm here to cover it all. But I'm also here to use whatever skills I have and information I have to inform the public. And that means presenting the truth to the best of my ability to establish it. So allowing somebody just to use whatever outlet I have as a conveyor belt to repeat lies, that's not the job of a reporter. But how do you do? I mean, as I mentioned with Brian Stelter when we talked about this, I don't have the answers to this. I think that we may, I don't think he's actually going to run, but my God, if he does, and he certainly may, I don't know what that looks like. We don't live in we don't want to be a one-party state. You know, we don't want the press to be all in with one. That's terrible for lots of reasons. But, you know, when you have one candidate in a race that is basically running against the system that you are, you know, the whole process that you're covering and trying to undermine that system and undermine that process, I don't know I don't have a full clear sense of how we do that.
But the fact that this conversation is taking place, well, let me make that a question. This conversation is, in fact, taking place not just between you and Brian Stelter, right? But in all the newsrooms in America today.
100%. 100%.
Right, networks.
Yes.
And people recognize that they can't just let Trump be unfiltered. And also, isn't it true that the guests that they book, right, can also not just be some of these crazies, right? You can't give them time just to go in there and say stuff that you know is bullshit, right?
Yeah. Again, you want to cover the full spectrum of the political system here, but you don't book Matt Gaetz to talk about election integrity, you know?
One thing I have noticed is that mainline anchors and reporters today, they'll make a point of saying, you know, Trump says that that there was massive fraud in 2020, for which they will add, for which there is zero evidence, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a step forward, right? Mm-hmm. They also recognize I can't just repeat it without mentioning again. There's not a scintilla of truth to the whole to that lie. It's going to be interesting how that whole conversation plays out, and probably the subject of your next book, Jonathan Karl.
We shall see. Thank you, Bill. It's great to talk to you.
Great to talk, and congratulations on the book, Jonathan. Betrayal, the final act of the Trump Show, Jonathan Karl. Thanks, Jonathan.
Great. Thanks, Bill.
And that's it for today's podcast with Jonathan Karl. His book, Betrayal, and there's a link to purchase the book. I strongly recommend you buy it and read it. The link will be on the episode notes to today's podcast. Again, that's it for today, but we'll be back on Friday with our Reporters Roundtable. Going to be interesting this week to see whether Congress can get its act together to do anything about the Defense Authorization Bill, the debt ceiling, and the big Build Back Better bill, all of which awaiting action. We'll see if that happens. And talk about anything else in the news with three of Washington's top political reporters on Friday. In the meantime, take care of yourself, stay safe, stay sane, and come back and see us for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.